Good afternoon. Welcome. This is a panel, as you know, entitled Andy Griffith, Don Knotts, and Mayberry's New Perspectives. And we have not one, but two books about the Andy Griffith Show and the creation of Mayberry in the popular culture of the 1960s. I'm Kay Slaughter, moderator for this panel, and a former city councilor and mayor who used to be on this dais many, many years ago, so I'm having little flashbacks. But I'm happy to be here for the book festival. And also to express appreciation to the city for providing this venue, and they're also recording this live now, and it will be on Channel 10, and then it's, as you may know, rebroadcast during the year so people who weren't able to come can see it. It will also be on available online at charlottesville.org, the city's website, /TV10. So if you like the program and have neighbors or friends, you can tell them that they can see it then. If you have questions during the question and answer period of the discussion, if you'd raise your hand because it is being recorded, and then one of the assistants or volunteers will bring you a mic so that everyone here can hear you, but also that so that your question will be broadcast. I want to also thank, in general, the program sponsors that you will see advertised in the programs around. We really appreciate the corporate sponsors and, of course, many individuals who contribute whatever amounts they can to keep most of the events at the festival free of charge. And ask that you consider, during your time at the festival, making a contribution either online at virginiabook.com or picking up an envelope at the Omni Hotel where the headquarters are and making a small donation in that way. Also, afterwards, we'll have plenty of time. We will allow plenty of time for you to be able to purchase books, meet the authors, get them to sign it if you would like. And so we will do that. Our format's going to be introductions and readings and then presentations by the authors. I'll have a couple of questions to start them off and hopefully give you time to think of your questions. And then, but we really want to hear from you what you would like to ask the authors. Now, and I'm going to do this very same thing because I forgot, I would ask everyone if you would get your cell phone, any devices that beep or whatever, and if you could turn those off now so that we won't be interrupted during the program, and I also shall do that. Demonstration. Da. Turn off. So, as I said, the panel focuses on two books about the Andy Griffith Show and Mayberry, and the perspectives are those of the two authors, Daniel DeVise and Gustavo Perez Fermat. DeVise is who's the author of Andy and Don. Spent 23 years as a journalist at the Washington Post, and he just told me, and I thought, I know I'm a daily reader of the Post, and I'm like, where have I read his byline? What particular stories? But he was here in Charlottesville a few years ago covering the Patricia Sullivan president story when the Board of Visitors was trying to get rid of our president, and they didn't succeed. But anyway, it was a... anybody who lives here in Charlottesville will remember it was a big story. And David was here getting to know us and getting to know the issues. He also had worked at the Miami Herald and for some years. And, of course, our other speaker lived in Miami, too, as you will learn recently. He's won many journalism awards, including part of a Pulitzer Prize. And he co-wrote a memoir of amnesia, I forgot to remember. Don Knotts was his brother-in-law, so an interesting fact. He lives in Garrett Park and with his wife and children, where he helps manage his son's youth baseball team and also plays in a band. Gustavo Perez Fermat was born in Cuba, but he grew up in Little Havana in Miami. And his book, A Cuban in Mayberry, Looking Back at America's Hometown, really presents this point of view of someone who has come to America and is now looking at this quintessential, quotes, American town. But he's also published a number of other books of literary and cultural criticism, as well as several collections of poetry in English and in Spanish. He's currently a professor of humanities at Columbia University, but he has also spent time at Duke University and still is a resident of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Is your other panel tonight?
Yes.
He will be in another panel tonight, which is A State of Many Nations, Immigration and the Changing Face of Virginia, which is at 6 o'clock tonight at Culbreth, so some of you may want to see that too. So we'll hear first from Mr. DeVisi and then from Mr. Perez Fermat. I'll start the questioning, as I said, and then we'll look to you. So, Dan.
Okay. So should I go right into the little excerpt here?
Sure.
The reading? It's a very short reading. Try to stay awake. Don Knotts and his wife, Kay, spent the evening of February 15th, 1960, playing bridge in the beige-carpeted living room of Pat and Marjorie Harrington. Pat Harrington? Remember him? Just passed away. The Harringtons lived in a rented Spanish colonial on LeConte Avenue. They probably call it LeConte. LeConte Avenue in Westwood, not far from the historic Fox Theater in UCLA. The room was large but sparsely furnished, a baby grand piano, butterfly chairs, and a coffee table around which the two couples sat. Pat was a young actor yet to hit his peak as the mustachioed handyman Schneider in the urban sitcom One Day at a Time. He and Don had struck up a casual friendship on the set of The Steve Allen Show, an irreverent sketch comedy affair that had just migrated from New York to Hollywood. The cast had moved west with the show, and the shared journey had fortified the friendship between Don and Pat. This night was bridge night. Don took his bridge seriously. He's a very competitive man. Steve Allen would air at 10 o'clock, yet that Monday evening was a night off for Don and Pat, whose show had passed from live broadcast to pre-recorded tape with the move west. The death knell, it turned out. The gathering was bittersweet. Steve Allen had just been canceled, a victim of diminished energy and dwindling ambitions, maladies Don attributed to the retreat from live broadcast. Both Don and Pat would soon be out of work, but Pat, at least, had a gig on the horizon, a recurring role on The Danny Thomas Show, which was a CBS ratings powerhouse that aired an hour before Steve Allen. At 9 o'clock, Pat paused the bridge game so he could watch that night's episode. He switched on the set. As the dot of light swelled to life on the screen, Don beheld the face of an old friend. I'm half done here. The program opened with a hand-drawn sketch of Andy Griffith, a young actor from North Carolina with wild eyes and tousled hair, known chiefly for his jubilant portrayal of farm boy Will Stockdale in the Southern military farce No Time for Sergeants, first on Broadway and then in the movies. The drawing shortly gave way to a shot of Andy sitting in a Ford Galaxy 500 squad car escorting Danny Thomas and his family through a town called Mayberry. Andy was its sheriff. "You picked on the wrong guy this time, Clem," Danny bristled. "Name ain't Clem," Andy replied, his face cleaving into a broad grin. "It's Andy, Andy Taylor." On that cue, the audience erupted in polite applause. Andy and Don had lost touch since forging a powerful bond in the Broadway cast of No Time for Sergeants half a decade earlier. Now they were 3,000 miles apart, Don in Hollywood, Andy in New York, and they had allowed their correspondence to fall off. Andy was unaware Steve Allen had been canceled. Don had no inkling Andy was working on a television show. As Don beheld Andy on Pat Harrington's television set, quote, "The wheels in my brain began to whirl," Don recalled. The part of Sheriff Andy Taylor seemed perfect for Andy. A show like that would be honey to the sponsors with all its homespun charm. And Don wondered if there just might be a place for him in Mayberry. A part on Andy's new show just might rekindle Don's career and revive his old friendship with Andy. Don had always hoped he and Andy might work together again someday. Don told no one at the bridge table of his plans. He wasn't about to give Pat Harrington a jump on his part. He waited till the next day. Then he placed a call to New York, where Andy was headlining a half-hearted Broadway musical titled Destry Rides Again. Andy was surprised and delighted, as he always was, to hear from Don. Don told Andy how much he'd enjoyed the pilot. Then he asked, "Listen, don't you think Sheriff Andy Taylor ought to have a deputy?"
Well, I'm going to read two very short excerpts. The first one explains the title, the sort of rather bizarre title of A Cuban in Mayberry. What's a Cuban doing in Mayberry? And, well, this is the explanation. The debut episodes of Tags aired on Monday, October 3, 1960. Exactly 3 weeks later, on October 24th, I left Cuba with my parents, my two brothers and my sister, on an overnight ferry to Key West. I was called, of all things, the city of Havana. I was 11 years old. My parents were in their late 30s. That Monday evening, CBS broadcast the fourth episode of Tags, an episode called Ellie Comes to Town. Ellie was the first of Andy's many girlfriends. And so that as Ellie was settling into Mayberry, I was aboard the city of Havana, beginning my own road to Mayberry, the friendly town. A Cuban in Mayberry tells the story of how I became an undocumented Mayberryan, the town's resident alien, the lone Cuban coot in a flock of southern geezers. If our work should be the praise of what we love, as someone once said, I think that someone was John Ruskin, but I didn't remember when I wrote the book and I didn't bother to look it up. But anyway, even professors sometimes don't feel like Googling. So if our work should be the praise of what we love, as someone once said, this book tells the story of my late blooming love affair with an imaginary town and its citizens. You can call it a Mayberry December romance. For Americans, classic sitcoms like Tags is the aficionado's acronym for The Andy Griffith Show. For Americans, classic sitcoms like Tags or Happy Days or Saved by the Bell make up the soundtrack of their childhood. The soundtrack of my childhood was Cuban talk radio and boleros. I didn't watch a single episode of Tags until I was already into my 60s. Some years ago, after teaching at Duke for over two decades, I took a job at Columbia University up north. Once I became a school year northerner, an unexpected thing happened. I started to miss North Carolina. I became homesick for a place that I'd never considered home. To mitigate my longing for the South, my wife, sitting right there, my wife and I began to watch reruns of Tags. After a while, the two or three episodes that came on TV Land in the afternoons did not give me enough of a fix. And so I got this series on DVD, all 249 episodes of it. And then that wasn't enough. And so somebody has pirated copies of the sequel, which was called Mayberry RFD. And so I got the 78 episodes of Mayberry RFD. And then after that, I got the reunion movie called Return to Mayberry, which was done in 1986, I believe. Okay. And for as long as each episode lasted, I was no longer a Cuban exile. I became a Mayberryan. I knew as much about the friendly town as any of the locals. For example, I knew that it was in room 209 of the Mayberry Hotel where Wilbur Hennessy got drunk and fell out the window. And I also knew that Barney, Andy's deputy, subscribes to a man's magazine called Love. As I spent part of each day in Mayberry, I realized that my fascination with the show had as much to do with my status as a foreigner, and more specifically as an exile, as with North Carolina. It's not always true that the allure of reruns depends on the viewer's memory track, which the rerun jogs. It can be equally true that the allure of a rerun can reside in the fact that it's not a rerun in any personal sense, that it takes us to a time and a place where we've never been. I envied Maybereans because, unlike me, they don't spend their lives among strangers. Indeed, they do everything they can to avoid them. Following the biblical precept, Maybereans love their neighbors, but to the exclusion of everyone else. The lesson of the Andrew Griffith Show is not only that small is better than big, that slow is better than fast, but that like is better than unlike. Someone who emigrates leaves behind many things, but none more strictly replaceable than the intimacy between person and place. Watching Tags, I came to understand how it must feel to enjoy such intimacy, to feel rooted in the ground under your feet, and to know that you live among people who are similarly rooted. Everyone was born someplace, but not everyone has a hometown, for the term designates an intensity of connection that not all of us have enjoyed. What I liked about Tags was Maybury, and what I liked about Maybureans was that they all lived in their hometown, which was the whole of their world. For Andy and his neighbors, Maybury and its environs, what in Spanish we call la patria chica, the small homeland, is as far as their eyes can see. Those of you familiar with the Andy Griffith Show will remember a hillbilly family called the Darlings, who come down from the mountains every once in a while and wreak havoc in town. And the patriarch of the family is a man named Briscoe Darling. He was played by an actor called Denver Pyle, and who has a very interesting relationship with Andy, because, like Andy, he happens to be a single father. You know? And so that sort of, even though they're very different culturally, they're sort of bonded by that. And in one episode, Briscoe's got a bunch of children, sons who never speak, and then he's got a daughter, Charlene, who marries some guy. And then in one episode, Briscoe shows up at the courthouse to enlist Andy's help in fending off Ernest T. Bass. You know, it's me, it's Ernest T., right? The rhyming, rock-throwing mountain man who insists on pursuing Briscoe's daughter, Charlene, even though she's already married. At the end of that scene, Barney Fife takes his leave from Briscoe by saying, "Adios, amigo." The only Spanish sentence ever uttered in Tags, but one that echoes Maybury's motto, the friendly town. When Barney says this, Briscoe turns to Andy with a puzzled expression and asks, "He one of ours?" Barney is very much one of theirs. He belongs to that place and to those people, though he is sometimes loath to admit it. But were this question addressed to me, of course I'd have to answer it in the negative. If nothing else, my southern accent, from the truly deep south, would give me away. Groucho Marx once quipped that he wouldn't belong to any club that would have him as a member. Unlike Groucho, I belong to a club that perhaps wouldn't have me as a member. Imagine somebody walking into the Maybury Diner and ordering arroz con pollo. He would be immediately run out of town. And yet I treasure what Maybury has given me, the illusion of belonging, the sense that things could be otherwise. The Cuban poet Ricardo Pagliosa once wrote, "The exile knows his place. It is the imagination. When I was young, my imagination took me to Cuba. Now it takes me to Maybury." As the grandson of Spanish immigrants who later became Cuban exiles, and as a son of Cuban exiles who refused to become immigrants, I'm happy to inhabit a world whose residents will never be forced to become exiles or immigrants. That such a world does not exist only makes it more necessary. When Andy Griffith passed away in the summer of 2012, all of North Carolina seemed to go into mourning. Local stations launched week-long Tags marathons, and thousands of North Carolinians sent in testimonials about the impact the program had had on their lives. I was tempted to add my own testimonial, but I was reluctant to do so. as someone who was raised by people who wouldn't know a dumpling from a duck, I didn't share the experiences of other Tag's fans. I felt like a stranger who shows up at a funeral and no one knows what he's doing there. Instead, I wrote Cuban in Mayberry, the belated testimonial of that strangest of creatures, a Cubanazo redneck, spick and hick in equal parts. So that's part of the... In the book, I weave in this way my own sort of personal story with an analysis of the show's themes and the show's characters. And let me read you a little bit, just a couple of pages from the partial portrait of Barney. It's called Life Imitates Fife. And Barney's the most well-liked character in Tags, but he's also, especially by the critics, he's the most kind of disdained. One scholar of television described him as a wired up, pop-eyed lunatic. And I was reading Dan's book, and Dan says something interesting in the book. He mentions that when Don Knotts, who was the only person to ever win an Emmy for the show, won his first Emmy, part of his acceptance speech, he said that he had always been a prepared loser. And that sort of, you know, made me sort of understand a little bit better where the character of Barney comes from. And I thought I would just read this about him. Alone among Mayberryans, Barney Fife knows defeat, his weekly bread. In one of the early episodes, Barney decides to resign from his job as deputy because the townspeople don't respect him. The final straw is a limerick that a couple of boys write on the bank wall. There once was a deputy called Fife who carried a gun and a knife. The gun was all dusty, the knife was all rusty, because he never caught a crook in his life. Barney's sense of his own inadequacy, when he gets drunk, and one episode gets drunk, he goes on repeating, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good. So Barney's sense of his own inadequacy is offset by his almost boundless capacity for self-delusion, which allows him to flatter himself with epithets. Reliable Barney Fife, subtle Barney Fife, eagle-eyed Barney Fife, Barney the Bulkhead. It's fitting that he plays the cymbals in the Mayberry Band, for he's all sound and, for the most part, no fury. Barney's high opinion of himself is rendered all the more comic by his looks. Stooped shoulders, sunken chest, pencil-thin neck, protruding Adam's apple. Athletic, he's not. When he runs, he waddles. Courageous, he's not. Confronting ruffians, his trembling hands can't retrieve the bullet from his shirt pocket. Well off, he's not. He rents a room in a boarding house. Articulate, he's not. He's a master of the malapropism. He turns therapeutic into therapeutic, introvert into introvert, compulsion into compulsion, and kleptomaniac into kleptominerac. No matter. Barney's talent is his pride. He sticks his thumb in his gun, sniffs, and proclaims, you know, Andy, there's no greater feeling than knowing you're perfect. Nonetheless, some of the most moving moments in Tags occur when Barney struggles with the truth about himself, where he silently, tacitly recognizes the truth about himself. Just as he fights the low opinion others have of him, he fights the low opinion he has of himself. Barney knows that he's not reliable, cunning, or eagle-eyed. He knows that he's not courageous. He knows that he's high-strung and sentimental. He knows that he's not big, strong, and handsome. And yet, he never stops fighting for lost causes, namely himself. The Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset once wrote that a man's greatest endowment is el don de insatisfacción, which means the gift of dissatisfaction, the gift of not ever being satisfied. Barney incarnates this gift in excess, a trait all the more noticeable Because he is surrounded by people who want nothing more than what they have. Unlike Andy, who's happy being a sheriff, and Gomer, who's happy pumping gas, and Floyd, who was born to snip, Barney is only happy imagining himself as someone he is not. Not for nothing is his last name Fife. High-pitched, thin as a reed, repeatedly sounding discordant notes. Cary Grant, who was born Archie Leach, once remarked that he dreamed of the man he wanted to be until he became that man. Barney also dreamed, but he remained Barney. I don't think too many viewers of Tags can really identify with Andy. You know, too modest, too wise, too patient, he is a role model impossible to emulate. But all of us can identify with Barney. Proud but fragile, restless but leery of change, easily roused and just as easily discouraged. And yes, like us, sometimes Barney rises to the occasion, fleetingly becoming the man he wants to be. Mayberry is a queer town full of queer people. Except for Andy and Opie, all of the show's regular characters are characters. Yet, from this rare society of kooks, we learn a great deal about human nature. And no one teaches us more than Barney, the oddball who is every man. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think you get a sense from both readers here about their books and their styles. They're very interestingly written and very well researched. In fact, when Gustavo was saying he watched all of the episodes, in the back of the book, he has a list of all of the episodes. It's really great. I kept sort of looking back at it. Oh, yes, I remember that one. But, you know.
My wife needs to be thanked for that, not me.
Well, thank you for doing that. That's great. So I want to ask both of you, in the course of your research and writing, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about Tags or about Andy Griffith and Don Knotts? Of course, you knew Don Knotts really well, Dan, but what was the most surprising thing in your research and writing that you didn't know that you learned, either one of you?
Well, I didn't know anything when I began watching, so everything that I learned for the first time. But as I went on, actually, at first we started watching the shows on TV Land, which are terrible, in the sense that they cut off the epilogues. And, the epilogues are so crucial to the structure of each show. You know, sometimes the best stuff is in the epilogue when Andy and Barney and Opie and Bea are sitting on the porch and just shooting the breeze. But reruns on TV Land and elsewhere tend to cut those off. At first I just thought it was a little morality play that taught us the values of parenting, of friendship, of neighborliness. And then as I hold up in my study and watch those 249 episodes over and over, I realized that the most interesting things in the show happen when nothing is happening. I realized that life is what happens when nothing is happening. And I talk in the book about those scenes where they stop the story. And the beginning, what happened is that Andy and Don, Andy and Barney, would just shoot the breeze. And, they would sit on the porch and Barney would say, "You know what I'm going to do, Ange?" "No, Ange." And then he said, "Well, I'm going down to the station, get me a bottle of pop, and go over to Thelma Lou's." A few seconds go by, silence. Barney says again, "You know what I'm going to do, Ange?" And then he repeats the same thing. You know? And those kinds of scenes, which at first the producers objected to, because they thought, well, look, it kills pace. You have 25 minutes roughly. You have to action. And those became my favorite moments in the show. I think as for many Tags fans, the show those moments when nothing happens except life. Life goes on. And this also gave me the sense that each 25-minute episode was kind of a little window into a life that went on. Between episodes. So I think that what I most I learned everything because I knew nothing. But what I most value about the show is those scenes where the story is stopped, where nothing's happening, where you have kind of uneventful duration. You know? And sometimes it's on the porch, sometimes it's in front of a courthouse or sitting shooting the breeze. Sometimes it's in Floyd's barbershop. But those are the scenes that I really love to see over and over again.
And something we don't see very much of on any kind of media today, moments. How about you, Dan?
I've answered this question different ways in different places. For example, I sometimes say, because it's true, I was surprised at all the complexity that I discovered in these two people in real life. You know, they're much more complex than the characters. But you can see that in the book. I mean, there's many dimensions to them. They're real people. But I think that maybe the thing that surprised me the most, I really thought about this question in the last 5 minutes, is how little it was loved by the sort of Hollywood critical establishment in its day. When this show debuted, it debuted to crickets as far as the critics were concerned. They thought it was a big canned ham, and nobody thought it was that good of a show. It got mediocre reviews. And worse than that, it was greeted sort of with a disdain by the New York critics and the L.A. Hollywood critics. I guess polite disdain, but disdain all the same. And I have a couple examples in the book of, and you could be kind of bowled over when you read this. It was, this is good for yucks, but, nothing more than that. And this attitude toward the show endured all the way through. And as it became clear the show was a top 10 hit, this disdain sort of hardened into this thing. Well, people love it, but, people love Cracker Barrel too, . And it never went away. It was like the Rodney Dangerfield of 1960s television. And I don't think the show was recognized as any kind of classic until literally decades later. And so go back to the 60s again. If you get one of these thick tomes of Emmy Award, compendiums, you'll see that on any given year, Sheldon Leonard's other big show, Dick Van Dyke, would get like 10 Emmy Awards and 15 nominations. I don't even know if there were that many, but it would sweep the Emmys, basically. And the Griffith Show, don't you all think it's about as good as the Dick Van Dyke Show, if not maybe better? Would get zero or one, and the one was usually given to Don, almost out of spite to Andy or something. I don't know what exactly was behind all this, and they were as perplexed as anyone. And so, I went through 30 years of clippings, and nobody thought this show was anything that special as far as something that would endure, like a sort of Beatles sort of thing that would be with us 50 years later, until maybe Return to Mayberry aired and it was the number one television movie of its year. And my goodness, people still like this stuff, And then gradually over time, it makes me think, I'm a big music head. It makes me think of like Led Zeppelin or the Eagles, these bands, or Queen that the critics all hated in the 70s, but gosh, people are still listening to them now, so they must have been pretty good. Sort of like that. That surprised me more than probably anything else in my research.
So are there some questions in the audience ready yet? And just before I'm going to call on you, someone would take a mic over to her in the back row. And I neglected to mention to ask you to fill out your evaluation, your green evaluation forms, but please do before you leave today, because this really helps us in the future plan new programs. Yes, ma'am.
For Dan, you mentioned that you are Don Knotts' brother-in-law. Can you talk more about that connection?
Sure. I was at Wesleyan University as a student, and I met Sophie, who's now my wife. And we hadn't been going out more than maybe a few months when I found out that her older sister, and this is in 1987, was dating a movie star. The fact that she was dating a movie star wasn't that surprising because Sophie's family had moved to Hollywood. They were sort of itinerant intellectual hippie types. I don't know how you'd describe them exactly, but they moved to places that they thought were intellectually stimulating. And I think that Sophie's mother was probably, she was writing, working on screenplays and such. And so Francie, my wife's older sister, my girlfriend's older sister at the time, you know, was working in the industry, capital I. And I think at one point there was even a question of whether she was going to take a job working in a sort of assistant manner with Tony Orlando or Don Knotts. You know, that boggles the mind. I mean, who knows what would have happened. But she wound up working for Don on a show that no one's ever heard of called What a Country. It was a vehicle for Yakov Smirnoff, the comedian. And, you know, they fell in love. And she was an old soul, I would say. He was, by her account, rather youthful in many ways. She said when she first saw his decked-out condo in Century City with the kimonos on the wall, that it struck her that it was sort of like a big kid, you know, living alone in this adult bachelor pad. And he was a lot older, but I didn't see any age difference at all when I thought of them sort of spiritually as a couple. So that's a long answer, but I actually have a little more to say. The first time I think that I met them together, they probably had to sort of vet me first to make sure I wasn't a kook or something, but I eventually did get to meet them together at Disney World. We were in Boca Raton working, and we drove up to Disney, and he was the VIP guest and led the parade, and we got a big backstage tour. And everywhere we went, people of all ages and all generations just mobbed him. And the kids would say, "It's Mr. Limpet," you know. And the young adults recognized Ralph Furley. And the slightly older adults recognized Barney. And the even older adults recognized the Nervous Man from Steve Allen. And then we moved to the West Coast and worked at newspapers on the West Coast. And during those 5-6 years in the 90s, I spent a lot of time with him at Christmas gatherings, Thanksgiving, Easter gatherings at the mother's house, and talked and talked and talked with him because I was a reporter. I was always interviewing everyone. You know, I was probably interviewing the two of you before we started. I always do that. So we talked and talked, and I found out a lot about him. So that is the nature of my relationship to him.
Any other questions?
Over the years, was there a stable team of writers and a lead writer that provided continuity, or?
I could talk about that, but did you spend much time exploring the different writers on the show?
You know, the thing about the Andy Griffith Show is that it was not only the Andy Griffith Show; it was Andy Griffith's show. In the context of movies, people sometimes talk about the auteur theory, and this is an auteur sitcom. And Andy is the auteur, and he really controlled every aspect of the show. In terms of teams of writers, they had kind of stable writers. Everett Greenbaum was one of them. Everett Greenbaum was the guy who came up with all the crazies, even though he was a Jewish guy from New York City. And then a guy called Harvey Bullock, who actually is from North Carolina, went to Duke University. And then when the show switched into color 5 years later and started going downhill in the view of most Tags fans, the writers changed. And for the sequel, there were very few, if any, of the original writers left. But some of the people who wrote the most number of episodes and the best known and loved episodes are people like Harvey Bullock, Everett Greenbaum, Idelson. Is that another one?
Bobrick and Idelson,
yeah. So there was a kind of a stable of people,
I'm looking here at this. I made a list of my 20 favorite, not my favorites, but I actually did some analysis, amateur statistical analysis of fans and see what they liked and compared that against what I liked and what critics liked. And if you look at this list, they were, I think, some of the best writers in Hollywood, especially in those first 5 years. Brilliant writers. I mean, the best writers available. And it's important to note that over the course of that first season, they started listening to the vernacular, to the way Andy would rewrite stuff. You know, no, they wouldn't say it like that. They'd say it like this. You know, he had that what do you call it, the patois, sort of North Carolina down pat. He's from there. And Don, being from West Virginia, had an ear too. And the two of them did a lot of rewrite. And so the writers soaked all that up and started writing Southernisms into the scripts on their own, even though most of them weren't from the South. Almost none of them were from the South. And there's this universality to these kind of Southern witticisms that they started using, like, Yiddish witticisms and stuff from, like, Minnesota, and it all worked. It all sounded like the stuff Aunt B would say. But I got a little bit obsessive about this. There's a couple teams that I thought were the best. Harvey Bullock was one. Fritz Ellen Greenbaum did most of my favorite episodes. At the beginning, there was a team of Jack Ellenson, Charles Stewart. They were good. Idelson and Bob Rick later on, fourth season, fifth season. There's not that many names affixed to the best episodes. Those are almost all of them. One other thing is, do not forget the director. Bob Sweeney directed 80 of the finest episodes in a row of the show. He was a marvelous director, had an incredible ear for poignance and pathos, and just he had this great sense of just wringing the emotion out of every single line, and you didn't get that. That walked out the door when he left. I mean, he was a huge part of it too, you know. Like, talk about the fifth Beatle. All these people qualify as fifth Beatles as far as the Griffith Show is concerned.
And the producer is a guy named Aaron Rubin, and he had an encyclopedia of North Carolina lore in his office. And there are some episodes that have to do with superstitions and so on. And the sources is this, you know, encyclopedia published in several volumes by Duke University Press in the 1950s of North Carolina lore. So it was a well-researched show. And,
Gustavo, I think you mentioned this in your book, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, in your experience, the similarities between Little Havana in Miami and Mayberry.
Well, a lot of strange people in Little Havana, too, when I was growing up. And it was like Mayberry. It was a closed society of like-minded individuals, and as you know, ethnic ghettos tend to be. And in Little Havana, it was nosotros, the Cubans, y los Americanos, and the Americans. And there was very little contact between the two. In Mayberry, it's us against them, and quite often them is Northerners. You know, there are really two kinds of shows, two kinds of episodes. You have episodes where a local creates some kind of disturbance. I don't know, Otis, the town drunk, rides into Main Street on a cow, something like that. But then at least half of the episodes begin from the premise of that an outsider, normally somebody from the north, comes in and disrupts order in Mayberry. And it's always, order disrupted, order restored. And it's interesting to remember that this show came on the air a year after the anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War. And the many, many references to the Confederacy, to the South, are fascinating to track, because in some ways this is alternate history. In some ways this is a fantasy. Mayberry is a fantasy of the South defeated but unbowed. There is, one example is a show called The Loaded Goat. And they have a progressive mayor called Mayor Stoner, who decides to build an underpass to connect Mayberry to the outside world. And so they're dynamiting. And the show has to do with the fact that a goat, eats the dynamite. But while these dynamite things are going off, Andy at the courthouse keeps getting phone calls from this old lady, who thinks that the Northerners are coming. And Andy says to her at one of his phone calls, don't worry, we're still holding on to Richmond. And it's fascinating to notice these references to and I don't know if this is deliberate, inadvertent, it was just part of the zeitgeist and there's one show where I think you can tell that Opie's, at the time there were actually literal alternate histories, of the Civil War, like what if I don't know, well, Stonewall Jackson had been drunk at Appomattox or Appomattox, something like that. There were also Civil War games, Civil War toy soldiers. And I think there was one episode where Opie is actually playing with Civil War toy soldiers, you know, sort of reenacting a Civil War battle. There's another episode that turns on the fact that this old guy who's broke and owes the town money has a bond, you know, going back 100 years, but it turns out to be a Confederate bond, and thus Mayberry's not obliged to pay it, you know? And somebody else's proudest possession is a letter from the president. And who is the president?
Jefferson Davis.
No, right. Yes. You see, not episode two, right? So so that's another interesting thing about the show, you know, the historical references. And again, that has a lot to do somehow with you know, life in Little Havana growing up, where it was all about Cuba. It was all about, you know, the exiled Cubans as opposed to the, you know, to the Castro dictatorship. And so on the one hand, it was a very similar and as I say, kind of a hermetic world of people who all sounded the same and felt the same. And one of the things I love about the show, is how smoothly, and this is true of some of you, it's true of you, Kay, the way you speak, of how smoothly words flow from their mouths. No, I mean, I have a nervous tongue. I have a nervous tongue in Spanish and in English. And yet, you know, people in the show, it's as sweet as sourwood honey, to use an expression. No? The way the words flow, they have comfortable mouths. You know, and this is something I envy a tremendous amount, people with comfortable mouths. Because sometimes I learned Spanish first and I learned English, and so I'm sort of uncomfortable in two languages. But people from Mayberry, and they have such comfortable mouths, and it is music to my ears just to listen to them speak. You know?
We have a comfortable mouth here.
Absolutely, a comfortable mouth from Australia. My wife is from Uganda, I'm from Australia. We're both big fans of the show, which speaks to its international appeal. One thing that strikes us is there seems to be a very close relationship between Andy and Ron Howard that transcends the acting and their roles. And I just wonder if you could speak to that.
Between Andy and?
Ron Howard.
Brendan Howard?
Ron Howard.
Opie. Yeah, Opie. Well, you know, the only person who can break Andy's heart is Opie. You know, Andy had a succession of girlfriends until they finally settled on Helen Crump. And in the first episode of the sequel, he marries her. But he showed a great deal more affection, you know, hugs, kisses, toward Opie than he ever did toward any of the girlfriends that he ever had. He always kept his girlfriends at arm's length. I think Andy Griffith said in an interview that his own, quote-unquote, difficulties with women sort of translated into the show. And so some of the most touching episodes are father-son episodes. And Andy Griffith made sure that every season, every one of the eight seasons began with a father-son show. And some of the most, you know, beloved episodes, for example, there's an episode called Opie the Birdman, where Opie accidentally kills a mama bird, and then Andy makes him care for the baby birds until they finally grow up old enough and they fly away. And that's such a moving show because it's a show about orphanhood. You know, these birds are without a mama, as Opie is without a mama, and as Andy was without a mama, because Andy himself is an orphan. Andy himself was raised by Aunt B. So apparently he was orphaned both from his mother and his father. And so I think you're right. I think there's a very, very, very close relationship between father and son. And then when Andy decides to get a steady girlfriend, Helen Crump, there's an episode where Opie gets jealous. And there's one of these wonderful scenes in the porch where Andy puts Opie in his lap and tells him, look, there's no marrying here. Okay, so don't worry. The real marriage. And also, he's very unaffectionate toward Aunt B, and vice versa. And I think partly it has to do with their offstage chemistry, that Francis Bavier, who played Aunt B, and Andy Griffiths didn't get along. But there's no affection between nephew and aunt. What affection there is of the show, and there's a great deal of it, is always between father and son, and then between sheriff and deputy, who's also kind of a father-son relationship.
Was that off-screen as well? Did they have a close relationship off-screen as well, Andy and Ron Howard?
Off the screen, I don't know.
Well, it's funny. Someone could easily do a book about that relationship. It was a really close relationship as well. It wasn't quite so much the comedic force of the show as was the relationship between these two guys, but it was a wonderful, tender relationship. And Ronnie was originally going to be more center stage in the show. I think Don sort of displaced him a little bit. I mean, I think he was happy about that. He told me he was happy about it. He was happy being a little more of a secondary character. He was like six, you know. He wasn't gunning for top billing or anything. They found themselves in the back of a sedan in 1985 or 6 when they were filming The Return to Mayberry, and now Ron was an adult, and he'd already, I think, directed Splash, and he was getting to be a little bit of a honcho. He had his own production company. So there's Andy and Ronnie, and they're stuck in this car together for an hour or two filming a scene, and they really talked and talked and talked. And apparently, at that moment, Andy really unburdened himself very lovingly on Ronnie. He said, "I really thought of you during those years as if you were my son. And I learned so much from your relationship with Rance, your father, who was always there on the set every single day, either Rance or the mother, his name I remember. I learned so much from the relationship between you and your own father. And when we were playing, you know, our parts, I really felt like I was your dad and you were my son." And Ronnie told Andy how much he'd learned from him. Remember what Ron does for a living now. He learned a lot of that from Andy because Andy ran the show, owned half the show and ran it and was the leader of that ensemble. And Ronnie learned a lot from him and from watching him from age 6 until about age, whatever, 14, and was taking notes in that big head of his, you know, that large brain he has. So that was a real touching moment in my reporting when Ronnie explained that to me. But yeah, as you were saying that, I was thinking, geez, somebody could really, I mean, Ronnie himself could do a book, you know, Andy and Opie. I mean, they had a wonderful relationship. And Andy, of course, had two adopted children, and I interviewed the one living child, Dixie, and she, by her account, he was a wonderful father to her, really, really loving, just like you'd hope he'd be in real life.
Other questions? A couple on the other side.
You spoke of complexity from Andy and Don. I'm wondering if it's not too invasive. Could you talk about, just pick out a complexity and
their human sides?
Yeah.
Sure. A buddy of mine who works at the Charlotte Observer did a nifty little piece that kind of bullet pointed 6 or 8 things, you know. Some of them are a little tabloidy, some of them are just cute, but there are things, they're surprising things you learn when you read the book. This book wound up on the front page of the Globe tabloid, not once but twice. And I'm just saying that. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's bad. They do what they do, and I do what I do. But there's a lot of stuff in there that, you know, that happens when you write a real biography of someone, you know, everything, a warts and all biography. We'll start with Don. Don was a very nervous guy in real life. He was terribly fretful and given to just fits of sheer terror when he was going to go, especially on live television. He would literally lock himself in his room, sometimes for more than a day, and he was always afraid he was coming down with something. He was a terrible hypochondriac. He traveled around with a little satchel of pills and creams and God knows what. He was always terrified, rightly so. I mean, hey, it's nerve-wracking being live in front of anybody, but he took it real hard. So that was a whole thing. He was in years and years of therapy. He had a profound terror around the religion that he'd been brought up with in Morgantown, the sort of evangelical fire and brimstone preaching. It was more specifically a fear of going to hell. He was terrified he was going to go to hell if he didn't experience the divine. And when he was young, he felt like, I'm not getting it, I'm not feeling it. And he had entered adult life literally fearing he was doomed and was going to go to hell. So there was a lot. There was a lot in that. And he was a brilliant, extremely intelligent man, very, very driven, very ambitious, extremely talented. So he's a complicated guy. He had a hard time finding sleep, and ended up having problems with pills because he, you know, was constantly medicating to try to get to sleep every night. And there's other stuff, but that's Don. In Andy's case, again, a brilliant man, extremely intelligent, just radiated this glow of charisma. He was, you know, just movie star good looking and just warm and radiated warmth, when, especially when he was in a good mood, you know. But he had a temper, an occasionally explosive temper. Apparently, I didn't find anybody who said that he ever lost his temper on the set. He was a wonderful leader of the show, the Griffith Show. It was more of a brooding, quiet sort of anger. And if you read George Lindsay's memoir, he talks about feeling Andy's disapprobation. You know, like, oh, the silence would kill you, you know. But hey, it was just silence. That's not so bad. But in private, you know, behind closed doors, he would splinter doors occasionally with his fist, and once broke out a car window, he would get very, very angry. He had a temper. He freely admitted it, especially if you go back and read his interviews in the 50s and 60s when he was much more forthcoming, I think, than in later life, and then 70s too. He would just say, I admit it, I got a temper. And there was a lot of strife, especially with his first wife, Barbara. They were married a very long time, but it was a troubled marriage later on in the last decade or so. I'll leave the details to the book. Andy drank. I don't believe, what do I know? I don't think he was an alcoholic. He never said that he was, but he drank a lot. And this gets intermingled with some of the flashes of temper that he would show. And both of them, you know, they occasionally succumbed, maybe more than occasionally, to the temptations of Hollywood celebrity. But let me hasten to add that by the standards of sort of Hollywood celebrities, I think these two guys are pretty tame. That's just my opinion. I've read much, much, much more eyebrow-raising accounts of any number of other celebrities than you're going to hear in this book about these two guys. But this is—it's a real book, so it's about their actual real lives, and so it's not the characters. You know, I'm talking here about the actual guys. But very few people who've read it have come away thinking sort of less of the wonderful work that they put on the screen for us. You know.
Hi, I was wondering if anything remains of the backlot set that served as Mayberry, or whether the land was all sold and turned into condominiums, as many of these have become now.
40 acres, right?
Yeah, it's a place called 40 Acres, and I don't think anything remains of it. The show was shot on the Desilu sound stages, and that's gone.
I think the building is there, but it houses something else,
oh,
I think.
Yeah.
So, like, at least the facade, I guess if you went there, I think I drove past it when I was in L.A., and I think it's there, but inside it's not anything like what it was.
Yeah. It's interesting, the Desilu, I mean, of course, that was Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball, and I Love Lucy, and there are only three shows in the history of American television that have ended up number one in their last season. One is Friends, one is The Andy Griffith Show, and the other one is I Love Lucy.
Oh. The exteriors were shot at this place called 40 Acres. I've never really figured out what that name means, other than maybe it was the size of it. It's in Culver City. If you know L.A., that's kind of it's kind of off the 405, a few miles in. It's where a lot of my friends lived because it's a little cheaper when we lived out there. And it had been the used in King Kong and in Gone with the Wind. And the street, I think, where the Griffith House was, I think had like houses from other sitcoms. You know, it found heavy use. I think it's been since demolished. I don't know what's there now, but I think I looked it up on, you know, Google Big Brother, and I think it looked like sort of like a corporate park drive and some buildings, but nothing like, I think it's all gone.
But it doesn't matter, because we can get the DVDs and watch.
Yeah.
It lives on. I think this will probably be our last question.
You mentioned that Andy owned half of the show. Could you elaborate on the finances, who became rich, syndication, etc.?
Well, there's a whole chapter, or a good part of it, that I devote to the series of negotiations that led to Don leaving the show. Don was a salaried actor, a salaried employee of the Griffith Show. At his peak, he earned $100,000 a year, which I think was around what Koufax was earning. It wasn't bad money. But, you know, you talk about people now, probably the cast of, I think, Seinfeld were offered $1 million an episode or something. It wasn't that kind of money. My recollection is Andy owned half the show. Andy and Dick Link, his manager, together owned more than half the show. And I'm not a television reporter. I've never covered it, so I don't know a whole lot about the business of television. But my understanding is that made him quite a wealthy man over the years. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was eventually sold, and they profited from the sale. Don, I know this from talking to him. He received residuals, you know, a little bit of money when the reruns would air, but not for very long. I think his contract probably, he ran out of residuals after maybe a few years. I think he said even by maybe the early 70s, he was no longer collecting a single penny when the Griffith Show would air. Now, remember, it was considered a piece of ephemera. When it was made, nobody thought it was going to be on the air even 5 years later, let alone 50. So I don't know that Andy or Don or any of them paid much mind to whether they were going to be getting money if they showed it on Mars 50 years down the road or something, you know. But that's probably not a very good answer. I'm not good on the finances. If someone like Tom Shales had, or Richard Schickel, one of the, you know, industry reporters had written this, they probably would have had a better sense of that.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being here, and thank both of you. These are both really great books. I had so much fun reading them and got me to turning on Channel 2 to watch the reruns, but I realized I'm missing those epilogues. But anyway, I hope you will come up, purchase the books, fill out your forms, and feel free to speak with the authors afterwards. So we'll leave a little time for that now. Thank you.
Great to meet you.